welcome in to VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Danny Burke alongside Jonathan Von Tobel here with the Big Three, where we discuss today's three biggest sports betting news stories. So breaking news actually right as of now, JVT, in the MLS, Nashville SC has become the second team after FC Dallas to be withdrawn, or to withdraw themselves rather, from the MLS is back tournament due to a number of the positive coronavirus tests, sources have told ESPN. So look, we are excited for the MLS to return. Some people are, I guess. Some sports in the United States. It gives us a little positive thoughts. But now some teams are withdrawing, so who knows what's going to happen from this point on.
Yeah, so two so far. And actually, we were talking with Rodney Marsh yesterday. He noted with us that Dallas wasn't so much a withdrawal as MLS said, get out because you got too many positive tests. So I wonder what the details are on this. But look, I think this is... I'm interested in this mainly because this is MLS, right? And it's obviously in terms of the landscape a little bit smaller, right? A National Football League team is not going to pull out of a regular season. And this is a tournament as opposed to an entire season. But at the same time, you know, it gives you an idea of what this might be like in the coming months, right? We have Major League Baseball going on. Major League Baseball is having trouble getting these tests through, right? Teams that are sending in tests days in advance and can't get them back until Monday or Tuesday and having to cancel workouts. So I don't think we're going to have teams that have to pull out or cancel their season, but it just gives you an idea of some of the roadblocks that some of these teams are going to have to go through once we start playing with Major League Baseball, you know, and especially, as we talked about what yesterday, those are the teams that are traveling. So that's the kind of thing I think we can kind of get ready for, is this is not going to be, as we know, a regular season by any stretch for any of the sports once they start getting going again.
All right, well, let's go to the NFL, where running back Raheem Mostert is requesting a trade from the San Francisco 49ers. His agent announced this on Wednesday. He actually tweeted out that the trade request comes after months of unproductive talks with the 49ers on adjusting his contract. Apparently, he wants his salary brought more in line with Tevin Coleman's. Mostert is currently set to make $3 million, with Coleman due at about $4.55 million. I was talking about this on the Lombardi Line with Michael Lombardi, JVT, and look, these running backs are dispensable, as we've seen year after year.
That's,
and
pretty rough.
If coach is able to do it, it's Kyle Shanahan who could be the one to implement a new running back in that scheme.
Yeah, that's the tough part about this, right? Like, not only are you a running back, which is, you're right, like it's a disposable position, you know, a dime a dozen essentially, but you're also in the best system for running backs. So you can almost, like, you can't really make a case considering that Shanahan gets the most out of that position, I think, out of almost any position. We've seen it at all the stops he's been. And so that's the tough part about it. And granted, he's not asking for a lot, but you're also looking at a guy, Raheem Mostert, who before this last season had a total of 291 rushing yards. And then in this year with Kyle Shanahan, that offense explodes for 772. So that's the tough part about this, is you don't have the track record. And on top of that, your head coach is one that has a track record of getting the most out of your position. So you're sitting back and going, what's the value? Like, what are you going to get for? Did Lombardi say what they would get for a guy like Mostert? Like, with his last season, are thinking, like, what, fourth-round pick, third-round pick?
Yeah, it's not going to be anything out of the world, because you know what you're getting. Pretty much like we just said, it's the dispensable aspect of it, and really, it's just the plug-and-play kind of regard of it with whatever scheme you're going to go to. So he didn't really get down to the specifics, what they get exactly, but, yeah, it's not going to be anything monumental by any means.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. It's tough, man. Like, you know, it's like Andy Reid gets a lot out of quarterbacks, right? Yeah. Quarterbacks are more important, but it's tough to play that position and be in a scheme that really benefits you in that position.
All right, JVT, this is probably my favorite story of the day. Jamal Crawford has agreed to a deal with the Brooklyn Nets. How about it? The Nets, they're going through a tough time, losing a lot of players. I believe it was seven players, as we were talking about yesterday, due to opting out in the coronavirus. But now Jamal Crawford, the OG basketball player, coming back in the mix, JVT.
Yeah, and somebody was texting me yesterday saying that it was a waste, like Jamal Crawford wasted on the Nets, and I responded with, they have nobody. He's going to average like 25 field goal attempts. Like, he's going to go insane. And so, like, it's cool. It's a fun story. And Jamal Crawford, who, you know, last time we saw him was in the single digits, wasn't great, but the Nets need him. He's going to be a fun story. It's going to be fun to watch for eight maybe plus games. We'll see what happens, but I don't think he'd be wasted. I think it'll just be one of those where it's like, look, Jamal, we don't have anything going on here. Let's just give you the ball and let's see what you can do, because we got a lame duck head coach. Nobody's playing. We just, if, to your point, we were talking about yesterday, we just want to go to Orlando, get out of there healthy. And so let's just go play, and here's the ball, dude.
I already told Jacob I was getting a Jamal Crawford Nets jersey.
You think they'll sell them?
Maybe.
I mean, I guess you got to go custom. But I don't know if they would sell those. I don't know. I wonder if anybody out there has, like, every single Jamal Crawford jersey.
That'd be impressive.
That'd be a really good collection.
Yeah. All right, that's going to wrap it up for the Big Three. The Edge coming up next with JVT.
This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
All right, welcome in here in The Edge. My name's Jonathan Von Tobel, you know it, and we have an hour on tap today. A great show on tap, as we usually do, because not only are we going to touch on one of our NHL series, Coyotes taking on the Predators, we'll have breakdown on that analysis, we'll have an update on the series price as well. Later in the show, we'll have our Major League Baseball division previews too. We're in the National League, NL East, a very interesting league, considering that all these teams really tight in terms of the odds. Wrap it up, Jeff Motley's going to be with us at the desk as we look ahead to the Quaker State 400. We're touching on all the bases here today. We'll start, though, before we get, because I'm actually really excited. Paul Rabel is going to join us in just a couple of minutes, co-founder for the Premier Lacrosse League. Odds are up over at William Hill in terms of futures, but we'll get into the Lacrosse League and Premier Lacrosse League, I should say, what the format's like, what the tournament we're going to be like, and as they kind of get to the forefront in terms of sports betting, what we can expect as bettors and maybe some advantages because Paul is a player as well. But before we get into that, let's update what's going down at the Workday Charity Open. The leaderboard, of course, is, again, crowded. It's funny, we have talked about this. These courses early on have been playing very easy for these guys, and it looks like so far, at least over in Dublin, this week is no different. Adam Hadwin is the top of the leaderboard. He is at 6 under. He's done for the day. Shoots his first round 66. Hideki Matsuyama, my guy, Mats, a dude who I bet, like, what, 2-3 years ago almost religiously, and it never got through for me. But he is sitting at 5 under. And remember, Matsuyama, too, last weekend actually closed out the tournament very, very strong. In really good form on Sunday, made a push to get within the top 20. So Matsuyama playing and continuing to carry that over here. He's at 5 under, along with Nick Taylor, who's done for the day, Zach Johnson, who's through 17, Pat Perez, who's through 17, and Louis Oosthuizen, who's through 16. So those are all your guys at 5 under, and then 4 other golfers sitting at 4 under. Notable names there, Justin Thomas, who's done with his day in the clubhouse after shooting a 68. A quick note. Because we had our horses for courses. We talked with humans about this. And I noted that some of these long shots, right, had come through in our research, that some of these guys at 100-1, 300-1 had performed very well on this course and maybe worth a look at this point. One of those being Rory Sabatini, one of your triple-digit choices. Rory Sabatini, 3-under through 17, so he's currently tied for 11th. Steve Stricker at some spots at 300-1. He's 3-under through 17, tied for 11th. So we have a couple of these guys that are near the top. We also have a few that were shorter odds as well. But remember, we talked about this yesterday. I was a little confused as to why the odds were so long on guys who had good course history. And sure enough, at least on Thursday, right, we talk about it all the time. You can't win a tournament on Thursday, but you can definitely lose it. They're not going to win it this time around, but they're at least near the top of the pecking order, some of these long guys, in terms of what came up in the research for true strokes gained on this course. But regardless, let's head out because I'm actually really excited to pick the brain of Paul here. Paul Rabel, of course, again, co-founder Premier Lacrosse League, is with us to discuss what's going on with the PLL and what we're going to see here at the end of July. So, Paul, I appreciate some time. Thank you very much. So there's a lot to get to. So let's just start with this. Give us the down low on what the PLL is, what the tournament is coming up later this month. And on top of that, add why you think, because I would assume that sports betting for a sport in a league that is trying to get its legs underneath it would be beneficial, because if you bet on it, you got action, you want to watch it. So I know I threw a lot at you there, but give us the down low on everything that we got going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Yeah. And I'll start backwards going forward. So for a long time in sports, there have been analysts, journalists, even comedians that say it's not a real sport unless you can bet on it. And we knew that going into really building the PLL, which is the premier lacrosse league comprised of the best lacrosse players in the world. We have 7 teams. Traditionally, we play all summer long into September. Obviously, with this global pandemic, us, like the legacy leagues, all huddled up and tried to figure out a way to build a solution so that we could play. And we've done that. So what we did was shorten a season that spanned 15 weeks beginning in June and ended in September to this like March Madness World Cup style 2.5 week tournament. So there's going to be a group play between all 7 teams the first week beginning July 25th and then single elimination in the second week that leads to our champion being crowned on August 9th. All of the games are broadcasted on NBC Sports Family of Networks. 2 of the first 3 games on July 25th and July 26th, which is Saturday and Sunday, are going to be on NBC at 4 p.m. Eastern time, and then primetime windows on NBC Sports Net. So we're really excited not only about our league, but the distribution that we have. And then this year, as we had been working on it throughout 2017, it is officially turned on sports betting. And we went through all of the regulators across at least the 18 states now that have sports betting legal. And we know there's an additional 5 that have bills proposed and another, 23 or so that have bills that are going to be introduced or have just been introduced. So sports betting in the U.S. is a big piece legally that now that leagues are and gaming operators are leaning into, which formerly, as we know, was done privately and illegally through sports books off the record. So as we're showing up on this graphic here, William Hill set our futures. We're hoping to disclose markets in the coming week, whether it's totals, money lines, spreads, right, and even some props.
So let's get into, before we get to specific teams, I'm always curious. We actually were talking about this yesterday. We were talking about soccer, right, and evaluating soccer teams and, strength of positions. And you go back to the NFL, right? The quarterback, the most important position. And obviously we talk about how much a quarterback is worth to us. Point spread, we know how much weight the quarterback position holds. So we're talking about just teams in general in lacrosse. Walk us through evaluating a team overall in terms of position groups, the importance of each position group, and where would you start your research in that realm if you're going to get into betting the Premier Lacrosse League?
Yeah, I think you always start with your star players. And in football, it's easier to go toward the quarterback because if the quarterback's completion rate is high and they're getting the ball and they're moving the ball down the field, that team's more likely to win. Defenses, like in football, they're kind of grouped together. And I think the same thing in lacrosse. You don't focus on, one potentially MVP candidate and that person leading your decision around a bet. I think you look at the midfield and attack position and the goal scorers. And again, just like in basketball, if LeBron James is going to go off and score 30 plus points and have, a triple double, they're more likely to win. And so I think you look at X attackmen more granularly. Those are the, our version of quarterbacks on the field. They stay on the field the entire time. And then you have midfielders that have the ability to take over the game. And much like soccer, they play back and forth. And have the ability to take over.
Is there like a league? Because I like numbers. Do you guys where are you guys at in terms of your database for statistics? What are statistics for lacrosse like at this point right now, in your opinion?
Yeah, so I would encourage you and everyone to check out a new Instagram and Twitter account we launched called PLL Bet. And we have an advanced statistics team that is new to the sport, much like sports betting is new to lacrosse. And it's a game that's been around for centuries, frankly, and has been played at the college level, at the NCAA level since the early 70s. So this is all very new, but statistics are pretty evolved. And I think at a high level, you look at goals, assists, ground balls, takeaways, which are a defensive stat. Then you look at goalie save percentage. You look at face-off position. That's a position that is really interesting to us. It's much like hockey. There's a face-off that determines the possession after every goal, different than, say, soccer or basketball, where the team who just got scored on then gets it. So you have an ability to go on runs in lacrosse, and that makes the face-off position really interesting and valuable, but also a potential target for a prop bet on a goal-to-goal basis within. So I would look at goals, assists, much like soccer. But then if you look at advanced statistics in soccer, we're now looking at time of ball and stick for any player, passing from a quantitative standpoint, every game, completed passes. So you look at soccer again, a guy like Xavi Hernandez in Barcelona, who set records in the early 2000s of completing 100 passes in a game. That's an interesting prop bet in the future for lacrosse, is who has the ball in their stick, who's the field general. So it's a really exciting sport. There's so many intricacies.
So if you go over, by the way, and again, the Twitter account PLL Bets, and I was actually looking through this earlier today and last night, one of the things that stuck out to me from the account, more than half, 19 to 37 of all games in 2019 decided by one possession. It leads you to think that parity is pretty rife with the Premier Lacrosse League. The futures odds say that as well. So this is a league, it seems like, right, that all the teams are on relatively even footing?
Yeah, I mean, imagine the NBA contracting to 7 teams or the NFL doing the same. We certainly have a really deep talent pool in lacrosse professionally as well. But starting this league from scratch, we did so with 6 teams in our inaugural season last year, and then we expanded to a 7th. So you're getting, this all-star level caliber per team. And so that can lead to fireworks where every game is, or more than half of the games are decided by one possession, or certainly can be on a momentum spinoff where one team takes over. And we did have a handful of games where a team was winning by 10 plus goals.
I'm curious, because obviously Paul here, if you're watching VSiN.com, which you should be, Paul, of course, is an active player in the Premier Lacrosse League. What do you think your value is to like a futures board or a point spread?
Yeah. Well, I'd say partially I'm a pretty talented player that have been playing at a high level for the last decade. But you know, it's an interesting thing having co-founded this league with my brother, Mike, and then having to carefully, and we had these conversations with all the regulators, in advance. And then obviously the gaming operators, is that we have bifurcated clearly our lacrosse ops team. So our VP of lacrosse all the way down through, integrity officials to head of, officials and referees and so on. So I much like July 25th, when that starts and our training camp that precedes it, I take off my league cap and put on my helmet and just play on field. So my hope is that, for those who bet on Atlas, is that I can prove you right and return some money to your pocket.
All right, so let's take a look at some of these teams. And again, as we noted, William Hill has posted futures at this point right now for the Premier Lacrosse League. And Paul, one more time for people who are watching, just give the date when the tournament's going to start, July 27th?
It's July 25th, so 25th. It's a Saturday. The first game's at 4 p.m. on NBC Eastern Time, and then the championship game is on August 9th. So it's 20 games in 16 days. Yeah.
So I noted the parity. So if you're looking at the futures board, you have Whipsnakes at 3-1, the favorite to win the Premier Lacrosse League. Chaos sitting at 4-1. They got three other teams sitting at plus 450. They'd be the Archers, Redwoods, and Atlas. So let's just start with this. Let's look at the top two teams, the Whipsnakes and the Chaos. Clearly, odds makers are saying there's a small difference between the two. In your mind, are those odds accurate, and what is the difference between the two?
So the odds have already moved a little bit. Yep. And because I'm looking at my team at plus 450, I think we were around 800 when they first were set. And if you look at originally where William Hill was going, it was based off of the leaderboard at the end of a regular season in 2019, and then how the playoffs went. So Chaos were the number one team at the end of the regular season last year, and then the Whips won the championship. So I think that's why you have the two up top, is you're going based off of momentum and how they finished last year, and that's consistent with other leagues. But then if you look at Archers, Redwoods, those were two semifinalists, equally had a chance to take the title. And then Atlas, I think we're an interesting one. We're like the Dallas Cowboys or the New England Patriots or you know, the Boston Celtics of the 80s or 70s or 80s, where we've got, you know, again, I'm partial, but we've got a lot of the top talent in the league. We didn't play well last year, and we got kind of pushed out of the playoffs on a tiebreaker. So it's one of those things, as oddmaker said, well, on paper, they've got all this talent, but they didn't win last year. So where do they fall? And I think that's where we've slid up to plus 450. Chrome finished last year, and the Water Dogs are our expansion team. The interesting thing with Water Dogs is, just like an expansion team in other sports leagues, what you do is all of the coaches and the GMs contract, and they protect the players they want to keep. And then you have another half of your roster that's unprotected. Those are selected by the expansion team's coaches. And then you go to market with a chip on your shoulder. So their slogan is every game is a revenge game. And that's one thing that we know as kind of odds makers and viewers of sports, is you can make a guess or a wager based off of stats, but you can never and should never underestimate the kind of the firepower of the mind amidst athletes. So these guys are considered the rejects of this season. And I would assume that's why they got the nod, at least on favorites or futures, over Chrome.
Yeah. And by the way, too, out here in Vegas, we at least have seen that up close and personal. Vegas Golden Knights, of course, the right expansion team. And then they go, in the first year all the way to the Stanley Cup final. So I'm curious, in your mind, when you look at these, because obviously sports betting all about finding edges. And what's interesting about sports like this is when you introduce them at first to the market, it's obviously, people aren't as involved with it. And there's some really sharp bettors who probably follow it. So what I'm getting at is, when you look at these order of teams in terms of futures, do you see an edge with one team or the other that you think is maybe a little undervalued, that the odds makers don't really know too much about them? And you're saying, like, for example, Atlas at plus 450, maybe realistically we should probably be more at 350 or 300, and thus our implied probability goes up because those odds makers don't really know the intricacies of how these teams are built.
Yeah, well, I think as we had talked about it, it's a great question, but we're already seeing the odds slide a little bit. And I think that's good, because what William Hill's already seen is probably bets coming in and then that's shifting. And then they're also probably tracking their odds makers more of the social conversation. That's a big piece of sports is momentum. And so I think that's part of it. For me, I think the parity that we've seen here demonstrates that statistic that you shared earlier, that over half of the games were decided by one goal, and then we had nine overtime games. So, and then the structure of the tournament. So there's group play to determine seeding, Remember, there's 20 games in 16 days. So you want to think about endurance, maybe age, average on teams, and different things that could lead to maybe a downturn or an upturn once the elimination round comes. So one thing to keep in mind, no team will be eliminated from the single elimination bracket on the second half of the schedule. So group play determines seeding, win-loss record, and then aggregate score differential, and then head-to-head. The number one team gets a bye, which is really valuable when you have 20 games in 16 days. So they advance immediately into the semifinals, and they'll have more legs under them. So I think we'll see a good fight during group stage. But keep in mind too, if you're playing futures, that even through the group stage, if your team goes 0-4, they could still win the tournament.
All right, Paul, we got 30 seconds left before we have to get out of here. So give us, again, one more time information, when it starts, where we can watch, and what they're going to be watching.
Sure. So our website is PremierLacrosseLeague.com. Follow us on Instagram at PLL, on Twitter at Premier Lacrosse. Our games are on the NBC family of networks beginning July 25th to August 9th. It's 20 games in 16 days. 14 of those games are on television, 4 on the main network, 10 on NBC Sports, and you can catch all of the games on NBC Sports Gold. That's Premier Lacrosse League.
Paul, hey, I appreciate it. Hey, maybe we can get you on again once you get closer to tournament time. Obviously, don't want to bother you while you're playing, but maybe get a little bit more of this information and we can get some people ready for it, okay?
We'd love that. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Again, Paul Rabel, and check out the Premier Lacrosse League. All right, plenty of show left to get to here on The Edge. We'll come back with a little hockey. We have plenty of golf to get to, too. Oh, and a clip from the world of mixed martial arts. Welcome in. It is The Edge here. A reminder that Point Spread Weekly is live. UFC 251 coming up this weekend. Great write-up by, as usual, Lou Finicaro, and much, much more. And remember, Point Spread Weekly, all part of our VSiN Plus sub packages. VSiN Plus subs are free until a major sport returns, so check it out. You'll get 24/7 video stream and replays, afternoon email, links to show highlights, special betting guides, and much more. Go to VSiN.com/subscribe for details. Let's do it. Wow. That's right, hockey. You got to get metal when it comes to hockey. The toughest sport of all sports. All right, Nashville Predators taking on the Arizona Coyotes. We are getting these previews one by one as we get closer and closer to the start of the National Hockey League's play in their two hub cities. So let's start with today, at least, Nashville and Arizona. Season series tied, one apiece. Opened up as Nashville about $1.25 favorite in terms of the series price. They were set, of course, to play their third before the hiatus came around and the season came to a screeching halt. So the way that I kind of broke this down, and by the way, you see the updated price, Predators, $1.30, some spots $1.35. We'll start, you know, offense and defense for both sides, how they perform in each, and where, if any, there is maybe some edge to discern between the two. So let's start with Arizona offensively, taking on what Nashville has, what they bring to the table defensively, because the Coyotes have really struggled in the offensive zone as a team. They rank 23rd in goals per game if we're looking at just basic statistics, right? 2.7 goals per game. They finished 14th in shots per game, 31.7. In multiple advanced statistics as well, Arizona has really struggled. It kind of just builds the picture up, right, of a team that is not really gifted offensively. 25th in even strength shot attempt percentage and even strength high danger shot attempt percentage, and they're 21st in expected goal share. Arizona is. Now, Nashville is not a dominant defensive team by any stretch. They're 16th in shots allowed per game. And the thing is with their goaltenders, they have a pair of goaltenders in name in Pecorine, who has been absolutely fantastic, and Yusei Saros, who has been absolutely phenomenal in terms of the numbers he's put up. So I think on the surface, it looks like perhaps that Nashville has a pair of goaltenders that could handle an offense that has been really lackluster up to this point. Here's my issue with Nashville, if we're looking at this from the goaltender's perspective, because there's been reports that Pecorine could be the guy to start this series off for Nashville. He's been there before. He's got a long story history. We know how good Pecorine can be. However, if we look at just the numbers from the season, it hasn't really been great, right? 36 games, 35 starts. Reyna's got an 895 save percentage, 317 in terms of the goals against average. Cyrus has been much better, man. 40 games, 34 starts, 914 in terms of the save percentage. And remember, we talked about this too with Mike Palm, right? Mike, at least, and he's much smarter at this than I am, when he talked to us and gave us some hints about how you handicap it, at least from a goaltender's perspective, if I remember correctly, Mike told us that goals against average for him as a handicapper was a little bit more important. So you look at it, Saros not only has the more, has the better save percentage, he's also got a much better goals against average at 270. So it seems like Saros is the better goaltender, and yet there's reports that they might go with the grizzled veteran, right, in Pecorine. I would not really like that if I'm sitting there, if I'm a Nashville supporter laying a price as good as Reyna has been, and maybe he steps up for the postseason. Statistically, wouldn't feel confident in that. And then you flip this on the other side, because Nashville is better offensively statistically, right? It's not that much, though, right? You look at it, 16th in goals per game, 307 compared to the 2.7 for the Coyotes. They did finish 5th in shots per game, but then you break down those shots. They did finish 11th in even strength shot attempts percentage and 12th in expected goal share. However, they didn't really generate much in terms of even strength high danger shot attempts. They were actually 26th. They were actually below Arizona in that category. So you don't generate much. And in that statistic, you're actually a little bit worse than Arizona. And the other factor, of course, is goaltending here for Arizona. And we talk about the pair of goaltenders that Nashville has. In my opinion, especially if you break this down from a numerical standpoint, Coyotes, I think, have the advantage at goaltender. Darcy Kuemper has been great in 29 games played and 29 games started. Antti Raanta has been absolutely fantastic as well. And you look at this combined, the two goaltenders finished third both in strength, even strength save percentage and overall save percentage as a duo. So I look at this overall, and my thought is, while Nashville is the better offensive team, statistically, there doesn't seem to be much of an edge there. I think defensively, Arizona, who gives up, a decent amount of shots on goal, but the goaltenders, in my mind, should even this out to the point where you can bring that difference between their offenses kind of back to even, right? And then on the other side, you have a goaltender, Pecorine, who might get the start at the top, and if he's struggling, continues to struggle, in offense, it hasn't been that great, can actually maybe get a little bit better. So you look at this overall, and I'm looking at Nashville at minus 130. I kind of thought that Arizona would be the spot to play if it's getting a little bit higher. If we're talking about Nashville minus 135, if we're getting plus 115, if it gets to plus 120 on Arizona, the initial thought here when I'm breaking this down from this standpoint, Arizona plus 130 to move on to the best of five series over the Nashville Predators. So we'll have more on these series as we continue to move forward. When we come back, Major League Baseball, the NL East, really interesting. Seems to be a lot of parity near the top and over a really short sample size. How do you break that down? Hopefully we'll have some answers for you on the other side. Make sure you're ready for the action. Sign up for First Bet, a new betting and handicapping product from ExpressBet. Use the promo code Vegas500 to get a $10 free bet as soon as you sign up. Plus, receive up to a $500 bonus for wagering in your first 30 days. Visit first.com/bet for more information. 1st.com/BET. Again, that's first.com/bet. Promo code Vegas500. Golf still, of course, going on. It's Thursday. We have the late tee times going on right now. Plenty to get to, but we start with Major League Baseball, because our division previews roll on. National League East, one of the more intriguing divisions, I would say, actually, the most intriguing division outside of, I guess, the NL Central by default, because there's so many teams that are kind of on even footing, but I don't think they're good teams. So I'll go AL West is pretty interesting. A lot of people like the Athletics. Lineup's pretty good for the Angels and the Astros, of course. We know how good they can be. So National League East. So let's just paint the picture here, set it up for you. Atlanta Braves, favorite to win. NL East, plus 180. These numbers courtesy of the Westgate. Washington Nationals, plus 225. New York Mets at 3-1. Philadelphia Phillies at 5-1. Miami Marlins at 80-1. You're looking right now, if you're watching the broadcast, odds to win the NL pennant. The odds I'm reciting to you are odds to win the division. So my initial thought when looking at this division is, okay, it's a division that's tightly contested, that is portrayed by the odds. Does that actually make it worth looking at? I guess you call them long shots or mid-range shots. Like, there's not really many, right? When you have the Braves at plus 180, Nationals plus 225, Mets at 3-1. The long shot, I guess, would be the Phillies at 5-1. But let's just start at the top and kind of work our way around, because every team has their weakness, but to me, when you looked at a lot of these teams in the NL East, there's a lot of intriguing teams, but there's also, you know, every single one, I think, has a glaring weakness. So we'll start with Atlanta, right? To me, the rotation is likely going to be their weak link. Mike Soroka could likely emerge as their ace, and Soroka's very good. 268 ERA last year, 385 xFIP, over 174 and two-thirds innings. Not a dominant strikeout pitcher, but he's a ground ball guy who can really, really induce, obviously, his defense to get things working. He's got a 202 ground ball to fly ball ratio. So he keeps the ball down, gets the defense working, and the Braves have a very good defensive infield. Max Fried, a bit unlucky last season, but still turned in quality numbers, right? 402 ERA, but a 332 on the xFIP. Better strikeout pitcher than Soroka, but his ground ball rate is actually higher as well. So at the top, I really like what the rotation is for the Atlanta Braves. But then you get into the minutiae of what their rotation. Mike Fultonavich, real issue with home runs last season. 177 in terms of the home runs per nine, posting mediocre numbers like a 454 ERA and a 473 expected fielding independent. You have Cole Hamels, who could be a solid three, but did show some cracks and, of course, is getting older. Cole Hamels has been around for a while. Posted a career high in walks per nine last year. Cole Hamels did a 356. And while his fastball, as of late, has never been like a dominant part of his game, his fastball velocity has been the lowest we've seen since 2012. So some worrisome signs there for Cole Hamels. And then Sean Newcomb, who was mainly a bullpen arm from last year. We saw 2 years ago that he could be a member of the rotation, could be competing for a fifth spot in this rotation this year. But he continues to have issues with his command. 382 in terms of the walks per nine. His career, it's a short career, but over his career, his walks per nine is over four. So Sean Newcomb's got an issue with command. You never want to give up free runners. So I'm looking at the last three spots of this rotation, and I'm thinking that there are some question marks that you won't feel comfortable with if you're looking at the Atlanta Braves. Now, of course, the lineup is going to be extremely impactful, especially near the top. Really like the addition of Ozuna. And then you look at other parts of this, and you realize that they have maybe the best bullpen in the National League, so they are rightfully the favorite. Right, to win this division. What about Washington, right? To me, the question now, I think, becomes if you're looking at this lineup. Obviously, they lose Anthony Rendon, who last year hit 319, had an OBP of 412, hit 34 home runs, 126 runs batted in. And while Ryan Zimmerman, who has decided to opt out, is not a major loss because he was a guy who was more of a depth piece, right? Look at this team overall in terms of the lineup, and you realize that, like, they lack kind of a true leadoff threat. Victor Robles projects to be in that leadoff spot, but he's only potentially going to hit 264, 270. At least that's his projected average. Again, these are all projections, so you could surpass that. He could also be worse than that. So you have a hole in that part. They don't really have a ton of power, right? Juan Soto, who's one of my favorite baseball players at this point right now, the kid's just a ton of fun to watch. You know, he's projected to hit double-digit home runs in the range of 13. No other player projects to hit more than 8 home runs over this short 60-game sample. So again, there's a little bit of a lack of power and not a ton of guys who hit for average or on base percentage is relatively high. And look at Trey Turner, right? Trey Turner could be a really big piece of this lineup, but Trey Turner has also shown that he has issues staying on the field injury-wise. Played in 122 games last season, just 98 in 2017. Both of those years missed time due to injury. Now, I think it was a little unlucky, right? Because considering that both times when he missed a chunk of time, it was because he was hit by a pitch. But regardless, now you have this track history with Trey Turner that he doesn't stay healthy and he needs to be able to do that, right? And then you get to New York, and rightfully so, because it's funny. I looked at this overall and I was like, wow, Mets 3-1. I'd be interested in that. And then you remember and you dive into what the Mets have going on here with the rotation. Jacob deGrom is freaking awesome. Marcus Stroman, to me, is a very viable second option in that rotation. And then you realize that Zach Wheeler is no longer with them, right? You realize that Noah Syndergaard, of course, is not going to play due to Tommy John. And then you look overall, they signed Rick Porcello and Michael Wacha to fill those holes in the rotation. Porcello has gotten progressively worse since 2016 when he posted a 315, 369 in terms of the ERA and the xFIP. Last season, career high in terms of ERA at 552 and a career high in terms of the expected fielding independent at 514. And he posted a ground ball to fly ball ratio under one, just the second time he's done that in the career. Issue with that is that those two times were two out of the last 3 years. So Porcello is progressively getting worse. Michael Wacha, he also posted his highest ERA, 476, since 2016. Second highest of his career and career high in expected fielding independent, walks per nine, and home runs every nine innings. We're talking about an expected fielding independent of 480, walks per nine of nearly four at 391, and he was giving up 1.8 home runs every nine innings. So this makes up the rest of the rotation for the New York Mets. And then you look overall, and you think, okay, so where do I want to go with this? Because to me, when you're looking at the division as a whole, 60 games will obviously lend itself to some randomness, but when these teams are so grouped up together, do you go with the known commodity, which I think, in my opinion, would probably be the Atlanta Braves, because for the most part, they remain intact. You know what they're going to have coming. Or do you look at these other two teams and hope that, like, of New York Mets, for example, guys who have been somewhat disappointments that they have brought on, whether it be in the bullpen or whether it be in the lineup, start to progress and actually perform to what they expected? Or do you go with a team like the Washington Nationals, who we know the season that they're coming off with, and despite the fact that they're missing some pieces, we know what's in that rotation and how good it can be. So overall, I came into this thinking that I wanted to play a team like the New York Mets, came out of it thinking that the Washington Nationals are going to be my selection to win this division, because pitching is going to be ahead of offense at this point. And if we're looking at rotations, at the top of this rotation, the Washington Nationals, I don't think there's really a question that they have the strongest rotation in terms of starting pitching out of all of these teams. The bullpen's really good for the Atlanta Braves, but I'll take the starting guys for the Washington Nationals any day of the week, especially over a shortened season of 60 games where pitching is going to be ahead of what the lineups have to offer. So Washington Nationals about plus 225 in that range. You can get a little bit better. Good on you, but I think Washington's going to have a pretty good year again and be able to steal this division from the Atlanta Braves. All right, when we come back, this is actually my favorite part of the week every single time. Jeff Motley's going to be with us. The Quaker State 400, Kentucky Speedway. There is a guy that has been on fire. He has come up in my research multiple times. The catches. He doesn't have a great track record over in Kentucky. We'll talk about that when we come back. VSiN Plus Subs free until a major sport returns. Check it out, VSiN.com/subscribe. You want to become a smarter better. You want to increase your betting IQ. Those two are kind of the same thing, right? Learn about like the pros and get expert betting strategies. Much more over at VSiN.com/subscribe. Betting analysis for every single sport, including, we're deciding it, we're digging the hole in, lacrosse. Is going to be part of the regular coverage with the Premier Lacrosse League coming up later this month. But I digress. So let's talk a little motorsports NASCAR preview. Jeff Motley is in with us here today. Of course, host for Gone Racing, which you can hear on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Get the details on this. I have this written down. Let's see. Oh, no, that's a football read. I lost my read. I'll get it for you. Anyway, you can tell us. I wanted to start with this because I thought it was a very exciting race this past weekend. And I have experienced, since racing has come back, I have experienced two disappointments. One was the first race back, I think it was the first or the second, where Jimmy Johnson, I had it 22-1, took the lead about the 90th lap and then wiped out. That's not that bad. It was only the 90th lap, but about like 220. And then Denny Hamlin, who in my research last week had come up in terms of a matchup against Harvick. Denny Hamlin, who had come up as a guy who I think could potentially win over this past weekend. Denny Hamlin, who had a lead with seven laps to go, and then the tire blows out in the turn, and eventually he finished, what, 26th, something like that?
Yeah, it was far back. And Denny Hamlin was the class of the field on Sunday at Indianapolis. There's no question he was the guy to beat. And it's kind of like, you know, you and I talked off air. What that is equivalent of is kind of like the old bad beat or the backdoor cover. I mean, it's kind of like you got a 2-point line on a basketball game and the game comes down to the last shot and ends up going to overtime and ends up being a 9-point game. And you thought you were in great shape. So I think that's the kind of situation there. I mean, Denny blew a tire. Those things are going to happen in racing. You can get into accidents, blow a tire, blow an engine, those type things. But I think week in and week out, you got to look at Denny Hamlin as a guy that's capable of winning every single week.
His form has been nuts. So can we throw up the Hot Wheels one? So we have two graphics here for you today if you're watching. One is track history. The other is guys who have been in really good form as of late. Hamlin's one of those. Average finish of 11.3, which, by the way, is weighted down by his finish just over the weekend. But over this last 10 races, six top fives, he's got two wins. Odds for this coming weekend is plus 650. He's among, six guys who are running, like, extremely well. And from what I understand, just reading, at the raceway, it escapes me. Where were they at last weekend?
Indianapolis.
Weekend, yes. Thank you. Over at Indy, it's a race that he had really wanted to win for a while. Ultimately comes up short, but he has been in great form. Flipping this over to Kentucky, What is his form over at Kentucky? Is there a carryover from something like a loss like that?
Well, I think like you have to also look at it. These tracks are incredibly different. Yeah. So they had raced at Pocono, Pennsylvania the week before. They raced twice on Saturday and Sunday. Pocono and Indianapolis are the most similar racetracks. In other words, if you're saying, what is most like Indianapolis, it's Pocono.
Okay.
Who are the two best cars at Pocono? Denny Hamlin and Kevin Harvick.
Right.
They finished first and second both days. They just flip-flop positions. They go to Indianapolis. Where are they running with seven laps to go?
Right.
First and second. So I think you kind of look at those type tracks. One of the tough things about Kentucky, in the past, we probably have been able to have a little bit better idea what's going to happen at Kentucky because they would have already raced Kansas. They would have already raced Chicagoland. Two tracks that are incredibly similar to Kentucky. Well, Kansas's race was postponed. It's not going to run for two more weeks. And Chicagoland's race was moved to Darlington, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So they haven't raced either one of those tracks. So we really don't have a frame of reference this year for what we're going to see. Now, Denny Hamlin and Kevin Harvick are the two hottest guys on the circuit. Neither one of those guys have ever won at Kentucky. In fact, if you throw out the Roval at Charlotte that we've only raced on twice because they just put it in, that's the only track Kevin Harvick hasn't won on.
Okay, I like this. So let's look at then track history because that intrigues me here for Kentucky. The top guy, and the way I sort this out when I'm looking at it is we sort it out by average finish. Then we have top fives, wins, and then the odds to win this current race here. So in terms of the research there, Kyle Busch came up top of the list. Average finish at Kentucky, 4.7, essentially fourth, fifth place. Seven top fives here. He's won twice. He is 6-1. The other name that I thought was interesting, mainly because of his odds, but tied in with his track history, Kenseth. Average finishing spot of 8.4. He's got three top fives, a win here, but he's 40-1 this weekend.
Kenseth is hard to figure, though, because, I mean, you've got to consider Matt really basically retired almost about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at anything he's done over the past 3 years, I mean, he kind of came in, he replaced Trevor Bayne at Roush, and now he's replaced Kyle Larson at Ganassi. So Kenseth's numbers are really, really hard for me to read.
Okay.
So I struggle with that one. And look, I think he shocked everybody last week by finishing second in Indianapolis. I mean, that was an amazing run for a guy who really hasn't run full time in about 3 years.
What about another name on this list? A guy like Kevin Harvick, 10.8 in terms of his average finish, top five, just one. And that's what I was interested here too, because average finish, you know, near a top 10, but only one top five and a 4-1 in terms of the odds.
You know, he's never been good at Kentucky,
right,
which is really kind of amazing. He had never won at Pocono. And then he went to Pocono last weekend, and he won once at Pocono and finished second in the other race at Pocono. So I think Kevin Harvick is going to be one of the two or three guys to look at. I just can't imagine Kevin Harvick doesn't have Kentucky circled now. I mean, you think about it. That's the only track you haven't won on. There's going to be a big emphasis on wanting to go win that race. So I think he's going to be a guy to watch.
And I would think, too, at some point, like, track history is one thing, but recent form, like, he has been awesome.
Yeah, and I Brendan and I talk about this. We'll talk about this on Gone Racing. We both believe very much in momentum.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's like any other sport. You kind of get that ball rolling. And we saw that for a while with Ryan Blaney. We saw that with Chase Elliott earlier in the year. And we're seeing it now with Denny Hamlin, Kevin Harvick, and another guy we're actually seeing great momentum out of, but he hasn't gotten to victory lane, is Eric Almirola. So, you know, I think momentum is important.
So that's the guy I'm excited about. So if you listen to the tease earlier, Eric Almirola is the guy that I was referring to. A guy who, if you throw up again, so this is, again, recent form. These are over the last 10 races. His last five races, he has been absolutely phenomenal. Is it five straight?
I think he finished the top three in five straight races.
Yeah, he has been absolutely
unbelievable.
So
top fives. He's had three top threes and five top fives.
There we go. Yeah, there it is right there.
So
Eric Almirola has been absolutely fantastic. So when you're looking at a guy like this, because that's what stuck out to me initially was, all right, Eric Almirola, he's a guy who's come up in my research the last few weeks. He's been running extremely well. But then you're running the numbers at Kentucky. He's only run there seven times. He's only got one top 10. So it's not a deep sample size. Hasn't performed extremely well. But it's like we just talked about, right? Momentum. How do you balance track with what he has done as of late? Because he's one of the best racers out there at this point.
I'm throwing track out on Eric Almirola right now. Number one, you got to consider the first few years that he raced, he was not nearly in as good of equipment as he's in right now.
Mm-hmm.
In 2017, he missed the race because he had broken his back in a crash a few weeks prior to Kentucky. So I think you really should go back and look at the last 2 years at Kentucky.
Okay.
And that's been with Stuart Haas Racing. And he's run better. Now, I don't think he has a top five in there, but I think he's got a top 10. He's got maybe a 12th in the last couple races. So he's run better. But look, you can go back and you could probably reference Eric Almirola against almost every racetrack on the circuit, and the numbers he's putting up this year don't don't compare to what he's done in the past. I mean, he's having the best year of his career.
Yeah.
He may finally be starting to, quote unquote, figure it out. And he's in a good car. Look, he's Kevin Harvick's teammate. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he's not in good equipment.
And that's because, you know, you're always trying to find, like, the keywords value, right? To me, the way he's been running lately, like, I'm seeing value. I have him, a guy who, again, has five consecutive top five finishes, is sitting at 28-1 to win this thing, 7-1 to finish in the top three, and you're getting even money to finish within the top 10.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about the top three is we're seeing his numbers for top three get smaller and smaller and smaller every week. He was 10-1 at Indianapolis. I think he was like 14-1 at Pocono. So now he's all the way down to 7-1 at mm-hmm. Kentucky. But again, you know, we're going to a racetrack that we really don't have any reference to go off of based on performance this year, because this track is completely different. I mean, you look at these five tracks where he's got those finishes, the closest one is Homestead. Mm-hmm. Homestead is somewhat similar because it's the same distance, but Homestead has more banking. It's not as flat, you know, in the turns as a place like Kentucky. And then Talladega, Pocono, and Indianapolis are completely different animals compared to Kentucky.
And the last note on Almirola, because what I thought was really interesting too is, so DraftKings has matchups up. The matchup that he's in is with Erik Jones, who's only run three races here, and he's got some good finishes, right? Like, he's finished within the top 10 all three times. But the way that he's been running, like, we're talking about value again. In a matchup with a guy like Erik Jones, it seems pretty interesting that it's only a pick. He's not even favored in the matchup.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. I think part of it is you're looking at track history. Mm-hmm. Erik Jones has been a pretty good racer on these 1.5-mile tracks. And the Joe Gibbs racing team has always been good. And you look at Kentucky, between Kyle Busch and Martin Truex Jr., I mean, there's several wins at Kentucky there. And you mentioned that Kyle's got two wins at Kentucky, and he's got those seven top fives. But Kyle came within a bumper of getting his third win last year. I mean, his brother beat him, literally by a bumper, to win the race last year at Kentucky.
So any other racers that we have not discussed yet that people should either keep an eye on, research a little bit more, that are on your mind?
I do think Kurt Busch might be a guy to look out for. He seems to be very comfortable at Kentucky. Hmm. The fact he is a defending champion of the race sort of puts a little bit of a bullseye on him. I think Kurt Busch is probably a guy that you might be able to get some longer odds
20-1.
And another guy we haven't even brought up, and this guy, I mean, he owned this racetrack for a while, is Brad Keselowski. I think Brad Keselowski is a guy who, I think he's, 8-1 to win the race?
Yep. Average finish of 12th, four top fives, three wins here.
Yeah, Brad Keselowski will be a factor, and I don't think there's any question he'll be a factor in this race.
All right, we got like last 60 seconds. What's coming up on Gone Racing this week?
Well, we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to talk about the Jimmy Johnson situation. He missed Indianapolis because he tested positive, but now he's going to be back this week because he's gotten two negative tests. We're also going to talk about NASCAR putting out the schedule for the remainder of the regular season, which is going to mean losing Watkins Glen and for the first time ever running the road course at Daytona. So a couple of news items there, and then we'll break down the Kentucky race.
I like it. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it again. Jeff Motley, host of Gone Racing. You can watch and follow, of course, VSiN.com. If you missed out on any part, the analysis has been great. Oh, by the way, really quickly before you go, you guys had a good weekend too, right?
Oh, we had a very, very good weekend, and we will be beating our chests on Gone Racing.
So I like it.
We would have made people some money this week.
Why is Isaiah here? I don't see Isaiah's name on this. I think Karina should probably be here, right? Not Isaiah. All right, yeah, again, Gone Racing. Check that out later today. All right, that does it for the show. We were going to play that clip. We're going to have more tomorrow on UFC 251. We talked about this with Matt Eumanns yesterday. But Jorge Masvidal has been getting ready for Usman, and it's one of those situations where, yeah, weight-wise, maybe he's not exactly ready this week, but from a preparation, a game plan standpoint, he's had his eye on Usman this entire time. So 251 is going to be fascinating, especially if that price starts to keep climbing on Usman. Maybe touching like 330 or something. Masvidal might be the play there. And also, again, great analysis from the Premier Lacrosse League. We're going to start to dig into that here on The Edge, too, once we get closer to tournament time. It's a new betting market, which means we might find some advantages that people aren't looking for. So VSiN.com/podcast. This is on any part of the show. That's where you go. We will see you tomorrow for our Friday edition of The Edge. Yeah.